I'm Peter Ford. I was ambassador to Bahrain and later to Syria. Many of these places being mentioned this week in the news, I was there. I don't pretend to be an expert on Iran, but from where I was in Syria, I got something of a perspective on Iran, and perhaps we can talk about that. At the moment, I'm a retired ambassador, but a current minor politician as a deputy head of George Galloway's Workers' Party of Britain, the original peace party.
So look, maybe you could explain a little bit about Bahrain, a bit about its history and how it's been involved in this current war.
Well, Bahrain is, the population of Bahrain is predominantly Shia of Iranian origin. And the rulers were sort of parachuted in from outside, installed by more or less the Saudi royal family a couple of hundred years ago, and they are Sunnis. And the Sunnis are about a 20% minority in the country. So there's always been a lot of tension between that part of the population that looks towards Iran and follows Shiism and the rulers who have been Sunni and to protect themselves have looked to the British and more recently the Americans to protect them and keep them in power and to keep the local population down. Now, that is a part of the conflict that's being kind of airbrushed out of the picture, but it's a major element in the big picture, and it shows how Iran stands by its people, stands by the Shia inhabitants of Bahrain, stands by the Shia inhabitants of Lebanon, and stands by fellow Muslims in Palestine.
So where are the loyalties of the Bahraini leaders, the Sunnis? Are they to the Americans, the British, even to the Israelis they might be? Where do their loyalties lie?
Well, the great majority of the people are on the side of Iran in this conflict. There have apparently been attempted demonstrations against the Americans that have been suppressed with the help of Saudi security honchos brought in, not for the first time, by the Bahraini regime. All this is carefully filtered out of Western media, so you don't get the wrong idea about how we need to stand side by side with our solid allies in Bahrain. Which allies? Not the people, the rulers.
Interesting. And what about Syria as well? You were an ambassador there. Can you just explain what's going on? I think the current leaders, many of them are associated actually with Al-Qaeda, installed by us, amazingly.
Well, effectively, the Western powers have installed Al-Qaeda, and they preferred that to having in power a secular regime that wouldn't kowtow to the West. That is basically what happened in Syria, that a secular government, which, while not wildly popular, wasn't cordially hated by a majority of its population, but with Western help, the Al-Qaeda gangsters came in from largely from outside, and they've been installed now for 18 months in control, not very firm control, because half the country is very unhappy with their brand of Sunni fundamentalist rule, but they've ensured themselves by humbling themselves to America and Israel. they more or less offered to jump into bed with Israel, but Israel won't take yes for an answer, and Israel has continued to bomb Syria and destroy the vestiges of Syria's army. Still, the present Al-Qaeda government, led by a guy called al-Ashara, continue to side with America, and they are very anti-Iranian. They've been quiet, as far as I'm aware, during the present conflict, possibly because a majority of the Syrian population will be very much against America and Israel in this. So Mr. Ashara is in a similar position to Mr. Farage, who I notice has first sided with the Americans and the Israelis. Then when he saw that wasn't working out very well, he's now jumped on the fence.
Look, something amazing has happened here. Al-Qaeda, we're told, were behind the terrorist attacks of 9/11, attacking America. But now it seems they're our friends. Okay, once they were blowing up New York City, the Pentagon, Washington, and now they are actually our chums, our buddies, running Syria.
But exactly. After that first spectacular action, the blowing up of the Twin Towers, Al-Qaeda never lifted a finger against America or Israel. They may have murdered one or two hostages, American hostages, to get publicity, but they took absolutely no action whatsoever against American military, even less against Israel. And in fact, their ideology is against Palestinian nationalism. They, in their Islamist fundamentalist way, are dead against Palestinian nationalism, and they literally trample on the flag of Palestine.
What an extraordinary thing to happen. I'd like you to, if you can, to pick apart a bit this. Syria was run by Assad, effectively secular state. The idea was, let's not weigh in on these various faiths and religions, etc. But it seems that we've got both with Judaism and Islam in that region, and maybe Christianity too, you can maybe inform us. We've got different versions of the same faith, a little bit like, you know, the Northern Ireland, where we had the Protestants and the Catholics. And some of those versions are closer to the actual faith. And it's almost as if there's a kind of gravy train of people who say they're part of this faith, but they're actually acting against its own interests, as you know, you've just illustrated there, discussing Al-Qaeda.
Well, the most tolerant of the three Abrahamic religions, Islam, Judaism, and Christianity, is Islam. They talk about the people of the book, the people who believe basically the Bible narrative, and the Muslims revere the prophet Jesus. They just say he wasn't the Son of God. But the other two are much more intolerant towards each other, or historically they have been. And this is the funny thing. A side look at my time in Syria. The Iranians, Shia, fundamentalist Muslims, were supporting a secular but in large part Alawite-controlled government. Now, the Alawites were, seen by themselves as an offshoot of Shiism, but the Shia themselves have been pretty reluctant to accept the Alawites, that's the Assad clan, as Shia. Nevertheless, they came to the rescue and support of Syria in its difficult days. I remember when I was ambassador there, a senior advisor to Assad was pleading with me, why doesn't the West cut us some slack? Why are you on our case all the time? Why are you sanctioning us? Why are you persecuting us? You're forcing us to get in bed with the mullahs. We're not comfortable with them. They're Persian, we're Arab. They're fundamentalist, we're secular. They have beards, we won't let our soldiers wear beards. You're pushing us towards the Iranians. But thankfully, in a way, the Iranians were not put off by any of this and stood faithfully by Syria for many years until the bitter end.
What about what's been going on in Jerusalem is pretty worrying, and the West Bank as well. I mean, we've had this genocide, Peter. I mean, it's absolutely horrific. One of the most disgusting acts of humanity ever, really. Comparable to the Nazi genocide. But the idea here, though, is let's deliberately target medics, doctors, ambulance drivers, deliberately targeting them. As well as journalists. So although we had about 60 journalists killed in the Second World War and the First World War combined over many years, so nearly a decade with those two wars, within just 2 years, there were over 250 journalists and media workers killed, deliberately killed by Israel in Gaza. And so what's been happening is there's been this attempt to stop information coming out completely, to ban journalists from even going in to Gaza. Meanwhile, slaughtering something between 60 and maybe even as much as 120,000 innocent civilians in the process. It seems there's nobody has been forced or made to pay for this at all. And so we're now supposed to think about Iran and not about Gaza. But I wonder what you make of what's been happening over the last couple of years in Palestine.
Well, in fact, it's all about Gaza, or rather Palestine more broadly. The basic reason for the present war is Palestine, that Iran alone has in the Middle East, among Muslim powers, has stood solidly on the side of the Palestinians. And Iran is a major state with military capability. None of the Arab Sunni countries has stood with the Palestinians the way the Iranians have. And therefore, the Israelis cannot tolerate this. They have to take down Iran. In a way, Gaza was just an appetizer for what the Israelis see as the main dish. The fount of all evil is in Tehran. After all, it's Hamas is nothing more than an Iranian proxy, according to the Israelis, who are, of course, in complete denial about Palestinian nationalism, and who ignore the important fact that Hamas are Sunni and the Iranians are Shia. But the Iranians are faithful to Palestine and the only ones left, the last man standing in opposition to Israeli hegemony throughout the Middle East. They had to be taken down. But it's not panning out quite as planned.
Well, yes, let's talk about the military side of it in a minute, but maybe start with the history of Iran, because obviously it goes back to a very, very long way, the Persian Empire, etc. Amazingly, it was Cyrus the Great of Persia that actually freed the Jews and let them go back to Jerusalem. I don't think the historians in modern Israel seem to be very appreciative of the fact that it was actually a Persian king that granted them their freedom back in whatever it is, I think around about 900 or 1000 BC. So they've forgotten about that. But More recently, after the Second World War, we had this 1953 coup, which the British were involved in, getting rid of Mossadegh, who was the democratic leader of Iran. And then, 25 years after that, we had this spectacular Islamic revolution in 1979, with the American embassy being besieged, and eventually the Shah of Iran, who had been a cruel dictator with a horrific secret police, was suddenly kicked out. So I wonder if you could say, tell us a little bit about that element of history, and whether the violent throwing out of the Shah was partly just due to Britain's involvement in the 1953 coup, because it certainly looks as if that may have been blowback. George Monbiot was on BBC Question Time last week saying exactly that if we hadn't instituted this coup d'etat against the democratic leader who wanted to have control over his own oil rather than leave that to the British, then that maybe the 79 coup might never have happened. What's your take on the history of Iran?
Well, as regards the 53 coup, I think if we had not interfered, not engineered the coup, Iran would have evolved positively and become a more or less democratic state. It would have been a beacon of progress, but for the reasons you gave, British imperialism, capitalism, that wasn't allowed to happen. But the puppet who was installed by the West rapidly forged an alliance with Israel, saw that being friendly with Israel was a guarantee of continuing Western support, despite the beastly behavior of the notorious Savak, the infamous secret police of the Shah. And before anybody in the West really started getting exercised about human rights, Savak were very active, being trained by Israeli services, hand in glove with the Israelis. And that is a major part of the reason why the Iranian Revolution, when it came, was directed in large part against America, in large part against Britain, and in large part against Israel. We'd all been partners in crime in repressing the Iranian people. And these chickens have been coming home to roost for a long time.
So with the coup in 1979, they have had a terrifically difficult time in Tehran. The Iranian government has been regularly attacked by MEK and various other terrorist groups sponsored by the CIA and the West, and the French, the British have been in there blowing up their government, planting bombs, etc. All sorts of terrorist acts, such as execution of nuclear engineers, etc. So, what do you make of the last 50 years or so since the coup? Sorry, since the revolution, and how the Iranian government has actually coped and started to build up, because it's been terrifically difficult for them under wave upon wave of sanctions.
Yes, sanctions is the key word here. We've been waging economic war on Iran for decades, and just recently, in the last couple of years, these have been ramped up by the vicious Trump regime, with the express intention of causing unrest on the streets. And that is precisely what happened. In a few months ago, the so-called uprising was a direct consequence of the American Treasury's conspiracy to devalue the Iranian currency. They've even boasted about it. This was the aim, and it was being achieved, and the Americans were seeing the results we wanted to see. The pips were squeaking, and the Iranian people were being forced onto the streets to protest against a government which had nothing to do with the economic suffering, which was all a result of American and other Western sanctions. And this was a replay of the strategy that had worked so well in Syria. It wasn't basically the jihadis who in the end did for Assad. It was the sanctions. The country was hollowed out, weakened, brought to its knees, demoralized by economic warfare, which is just as important these days as military warfare and information warfare, which has also been waged nonstop against Iran for over 40 years.
Do you not think that it's justified to question the nuclear program of the Iranians? There seems to be a sort of sneaky attempt here to get enough enriched uranium to be able to build nuclear weapons.
Well, I have an unorthodox view on Iranian nuclear. I think the Iranians made a mistake years ago. They inherited a nuclear program from the Shah, which had been pushed on the Shah by the Americans, who thought that Westinghouse could get big contracts, which they did. So the revolution inherited a nuclear, civil nuclear program. And there was discussion at the top levels. Khomeini, the first supreme leader, wasn't keen to keep the nuclear, but he was persuaded against his better judgment to go along with it. If only they listened to him, they would have been spared a lot of grief. And Iran is a country that doesn't need nuclear power. If there's one country in the world that doesn't need nuclear, it's Iran with all its oil and gas and hydro because of its high mountains and water, waterfalls, things like that. They didn't need a civilian nuclear program. But they made the same mistake that Saddam made by allowing the impression to develop that, oh, well, maybe they're using nuclear civilian to prepare the way for a nuclear weapon. And they went to levels of enrichment, which were hard to justify purely in terms of civilian nuclear. Big mistake.
But hang on. They did that surely because that Trump pulled out of the agreement, which had limited the enrichment.
Absolutely. And even more recently, the Iranians were more or less willing to give up their control over enrichment. I believe they were offering to do shared enrichment with some of the Gulf countries, which in other words meant totally giving up their sovereign right to enrich alone. But Israel is not a country that takes yes for an answer. In fact, I suspect that the reason Israel pulled the trigger was they were afraid that Trump was going to go snap on this surprise, flexible Iranian response. And they moved and preempted Trump and forced him to jump before he was ready.
Well, hang on. No, I mean, it wasn't Israel that started this. Surely it was all announced by Donald Trump, not the Israelis.
No, this has been driven first and foremost by Netanyahu for 30 years. And he winds Trump around his little finger. I mean, Trump is a man-child, easily misled. Of course, the Americans had developed a phobia about Iran nuclear, but not because even the prospect of a nuclear Iran was no danger to America. It was all about Israel. It's always been all about Israel.
Well, yeah, but I mean, just so what is it? Does Netanyahu have compromat on Trump? How can surely Donald Trump is his own man, isn't he? I mean, or is he being blackmailed?
Well, that seems a bit glib, an explanation. I think there's a bit more to it than that, frankly. That may be part of it, but it can also be explained simply in terms of the Israel lobby in America. The Israel lobby controls Congress, and Congress can stymie and block anything the president wants to do. Trump also surrounded himself with Christian evangelicals, like the ridiculous, I call him Comical Pete. Remember Comical Ali of Saddam Hussein's information minister? Well, Pete Hegseth, the American war secretary, is sounding like very much like Comical Ali, and he's a Christian fundamentalist. They're an important element of MAGA, though by no means all of MAGA. That's why there are tensions between them. So it's partly ideological, partly political, partly money, and partly personal.
Isn't it extraordinary to see Trump, the so-called no-war president that campaigned for years on this platform, suddenly launches one of the biggest wars of aggression we've seen ever, and potentially this could be even a third world war he's starting. Now, he actually stood, Peter, he stood against this idea. Look, they could start World War III. I'm going to be the guy to stop it. And now it looks like he's just changed his tune. I don't know if I can ever remember such a betrayal by a politician of their base, of their voter base.
But he's saving the world. He's not just saving America, he's saving the world, Tony. Or so he tells us that Iran is a threat to the world. I mean, it's become apocalyptic. I mean, there's a religious element almost that's entered the equation now that America is losing. They're grasping at straws and they're going back to fundamentals, literally fundamental Christianity. We're hearing, as you know, these stories, well, not stories, reports and complaints about how the American army is being given lectures in early Christianity and told that Trump is more or less the incarnation of God's will. The conflict is, as it's got worse for America, is entering another and more worrying level of illusion. It's re really, in a way, the most worrying aspect because you have, as I see it, three theocracies, three religious states. Israel, obviously. Country of the Hebrews, Iran, obviously, fundamentalist Islamist regime. But America is a country which worships itself. It has a cult of itself, and it believes it too has a mission from God, that it is, they call, and the hallowed phrase, the citadel on a hill. And you have to go back into American history to see the religious roots of American nationalist ideology, American exceptionalism, with manifest destiny to rule, appointed by God. This is coming out now. Now that America, at the beginning, we weren't hearing much about that, but the fact that they are struggling now and can see defeat on the horizon is making everything and their language more apocalyptic.
Well, I wonder which side they're on in this big apocalypse, the good or evil, who knows? But Pete Hegseth has been saying some extraordinary things, such as that Trump has been anointed by Jesus to bring about Armageddon. I mean, these are extraordinary things for a man to say, particularly who is very in favor of the Crusades and the Knights Templar. This is almost like a medieval war that they're waging. It's like they've picked up some of these ideas from many, many years ago. And are just carrying them out. But can you please say something about the way this has happened? Because, I mean, at least with Iraq, there was an attempt to make the war legal. There doesn't seem to have been any attempt whatsoever in this case. It's just simply been a war of aggression, and nobody, I mean, maybe there is, and maybe you can help me out here and say they have tried to say that this is legal, but it doesn't, certainly doesn't seem to have been anything other than a blatant act of aggression.
I think that's right. They haven't made a serious attempt to make out a legal case. But a bit like the Russians with their special military operation in Ukraine, the Americans at the beginning were reluctant to use the word war. And they called it their own special military operation. That was the well, a piece of hypocrisy. This is the homage that vice pays to virtue, hypocrisy. They were pretending that there was some sort of legal justification because it wasn't a full-blown war. Well, now that fig leaf has blown away, and they're not even trying. And in fact, they are poo-pooing international law. I mean, when you have God on your side and you can do no wrong and your ally is Israel, who needs international law? I mean, the Americans have been playing fast and loose with international law for decades. There's nothing terribly new about this. It's just been taken to its logical extreme by Trump. Who chafes at all restraint on his powerful ego, and who's now literally a scofflaw, the American word, a scofflaw. He scoffs at international law. He's a renegade in terms of international law and morality.
The United Nations is supposed to take a role here. It doesn't really seem to have happened. Actually, what we've had is a resolution passed to condemn Iran for responding by attacking the Gulf states, which, of course, are being used by the United States to bomb them, to attack them. So, what do you make of the UN? Is it just complete spent force? What's going on with them?
Well, as a former UN employee, I'm absolutely dismayed by the performance of the UN in this war. First of all, they failed to condemn, or the Security Council failed to condemn America and Israel. No surprise there, given that America has a veto. But this latest resolution, one-sided resolution, not only there's no word about the original aggression, but it condemns Iran for responding. The Security Council is blaming the victim for retaliating against being attacked. And the Americans, with their bully tactics, have railroaded this through 13 shameless members of the Security Council gave it their approval, including, of course, the British poodle. Russia and China abstained. I'm not quite sure why they didn't vote against it. They also showed cowardice, but in their public statements, they made it clear that, well, more or less, they said what I've just said. It's victim blaming.
So, is that it for the UN? What's the point of having it?
Very good question, and not asked for the first time by any means. It's useful when one of the parties involved is not America, which isn't saying very much. But the UN is not just the Security Council. The UN has all these agencies, including the Refugee Agency for Palestinian refugees that I used to work for, and it does a lot of good work in a quiet way.
Well, the Red Sea has got the Bab al-Mandeb Strait, the Persian Gulf, which I remember first hearing about back in 1989-90 in the first Gulf War, has got this thing called the Straits of Hormuz, which much of the oil is produced at the end of that, the northern end of the Persian Gulf, but it has to come out through the southern end in order to be distributed around the world. Now, it's not just oil, there's other trade which goes through there. That has been closed. We've just heard today, Thursday, that several ships have gone through, and that is almost certainly either Russian, Chinese, or Pakistani ships that the Iranians have said can come through. They're also allegedly suggesting that large amounts of money should be paid to Iran if they want to bring any ships through, any countries that are not China, Pakistan, or Russia. So, what do you make of the Iranian use of the Straits of Hormuz and closing it, and now apparently mining it too?
Everything the Iranians are doing is very carefully calibrated. There's a lot of deep thought and planning gone into their every move. Their priority is to disrupt the world oil markets. At the same time, they don't want to piss off too much their own allies, and therefore they're prepared to make exceptions for Russia and China, and also India, which is a respectable, neutral, reliant on Iranian oil. But allowing these exceptions is not going to relax much of the pressure on the Western powers. We are still going to suffer increasingly. It's only just beginning, the pain is only just beginning. And here's the funny thing. Iranian oil is also passing through the Straits of Hormuz, and the Americans are doing nothing about it. Not only that, but the Americans have studiously avoided bombing Iranian refineries. They've bombed depots which serve the domestic Iranian market, but they've not bombed, as they could easily have done, the Iranian refineries. Why? Because the Americans are so desperate to try to stabilize the world oil price that they're acquiescing in Iran continuing to produce, refine, and export its own oil. That shows how weak and panicky the Americans are.
So I wonder if someone had a word in Donald Trump's ear, Peter, and said, "Look, can you please stop this war because it's collapsing the Western economy?" Do you think he'd listen?
Well, he's got loud noises coming into both ears. There's the economy worry, and there's also equally important Israel's worry, because Israel is getting hammered. Now, the media are not going to tell us this, but that does seem to be the reality, and this is revealed by the fact that the Israelis have put a blackout on news. They won't allow reporting of anything that's happening. They won't allow cameras to show the skyline of Tel Aviv. There's obviously a reason for that, and I think we can all, you don't have to be Sherlock Holmes to work out that Israel is taking a pounding, as they did back in June last year. That was why the June war ended. And I believe that that is why this war will also end in a matter of days.
Well, you can predict that, Peter, but it may well be. I mean, remember that Israel is a nuclear-armed state. It seems impossible, really, for Iran to defeat them. They can just start to threaten and even possibly use nuclear weapons.
For Israel to use nuclear weapons would be the end of Israel itself. It would lose all support in the West. There would literally be blowback. There'd be clouds of radioactive dust going all over Europe. I really don't think it's credible for the Israelis to be brandishing this weapon. It's unusable. It's unusable. And there's a better, easier way. They can just let Trump declare victory, and they can stop the ballistic and possibly hypersonic missiles landing on Israel at much lower cost than starting a nuclear conflagration.
What? So you've said you think things could be ended just in a few days. What's your honest prediction as to how long this is going to last?
Yes, I'd hold to that. And Trump himself, just 2 days ago, was saying it's virtually complete.
Yeah, but he's just saying that to calm the oil markets, isn't he?
I'm sorry? That he said that on Monday, after just 12 hours of the markets freaking out. Trump is all over the place, but his behavior has been consistent with that of a man who is searching for the exits. He's using bluster to cover up his failures, the disaster of this entire epic disaster, and he just wants to give the impression that he's giving Iran a punishment beating, and then he'll walk away and they'll have learned their lesson. So when exactly he calls it a day is hard to predict, but I would hold to my forecast it will be within 7 days.
Okay, Peter Ford, thanks very much for joining us. And I hope you could just share any of your social media where if people are interested in following your work, finding you online, etc., where they can do that.
People, please just follow the Workers' Party of Britain. I'm one of the deputy leaders of George Galloway's party. Workers' Party of Britain website has it all. And, of course, George's own famous programs.
Okay, Peter Ford, former ambassador to Bahrain and also to Syria. Thanks very much for your time.
Thanks for having me, Tony. Been a pleasure.